ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Yes, Nick is the author of Don't Panic, Why You Can Retire With Less Than You Think. He's been battling a whole lot of problems at the moment. Nick, g'day.
There you go.
Now, you've been chainsawing and cleaning up because been a victim of these big storms in Perth.
Yeah, Perth is not normally the place you'd go to for wild weather events, but we were the exception this long. We've just had a long weekend, and the Weather Bureau was coming out with warnings, and it's a bit of whatever. Let's see what happens, but it happened, and somewhere recorded a gust of 125 kilometres per hour around Perth, and trees down. So, yes, my tree took out my neighbour's wall and gate, and my neighbour's tree on the other side took out my power line and pole. So the
insurance took out your power pole as well.
Power pole, yeah. Like there's a line that goes into my property with a pole, and then that goes underground. But that pole's been broken, snapped in half by the weight of the tree branch hitting it. So, all very exciting, but I tell you what, I'm not sure I'd be buying shares in insurers right at the moment.
I was going to say, don't tell me the insurance company have said, not a cracker. No.
I was onto that, mate, let me tell you. Even if I did have to wait for 25 minutes.
Surprised, yeah. Mr. Bruning, you had to wait that long. I'll get on the radio. I'll be talking about you with Phil Clark on Nightline. You'll be gone.
I'm a 1-800 number just like the rest of us.
Oh, I see. Anyway, well, I'm glad you and others are cleaning up after the relatively wild weather.
I suspect it's probably heading your way. I think Adelaide copped a bit of it. So
Anyway, what's going on? A report came out yesterday, which was interesting, about the stress of retirement and so on, and the what Colonial First State was saying was the biggest ever expansion of retirement solutions. What's all this about?
Look, well, there's a lot in the federal budget, which will probably come up tonight, with people asking questions about it and how it affects them. But this report was kind of looking at the level of fear with many Australians as they approach retirement. And it reports that about half of the people they surveyed think that they're not ready for retirement. They won't have enough. Interestingly enough, I saw that the hoped-for retirement age on average was 62 years of age, which is interesting because that's 5 years before the age pension kicks in at 67. And look, I think, you got to sit back and look at this stuff critically. And part of it is that I don't think many people quite understand the retirement income system as they should. And as you get closer to your retirement, you naturally educate yourself. But it's worth pointing out that, most of the people telling you that you need $1 million, you need this much, are generally people that are trying to sell you an investment of some sort. So whether it's a super fund or whether it's some, joke of selling a property somewhere to negative gear, whatever the asset is, but often there's a sales culture behind it. But when you sit back and sort of critically analyse most people, so there's a couple of decisions you need to sort of think early in the piece. One is, what's your end game? So is your plan to leave as much as you possibly can for your kids, in which case it's probably an argument to help them out along the way now. The second one is to spend the last dollar on your last day, which is nice in theory, probably the riskiest. But the third, which is what I think most people do, is they take the view that, well, you know what, I'm going to have a bloody good time in my retirement. I'm going to do what I want to do while I can, and whatever's left for the kids they can have. And I think most people adopt that approach. So in that approach, it's basically recognising that as you get older, your income needs will drop, and therefore the amount of capital you're going to need declines. And the reason we can say that is because the social security system, the age pension, is really pretty generous. And look, not for a moment am I saying that if that's the full income that you've got and your asset, you are devoid of assets, all that, it's not easy. It certainly isn't. It's very tough. But if you have some resources behind you, and a lot of people with modest amounts in super, it's not as bad as you think. And I think part of it, as I say, is this education of what retirees are facing when they get there. I've sort of championed for many years that you can do it with a sum of about $400,000 or $500,000 quite easily, a couple. You're living on an income of about $68,000 a year, indexed for life, tax free. And that's being made up of some of your savings and the age pension. And, we're not number five in the world without good reason, Phil, in terms of retirement income systems. And, the reason that is that our savings and super work hand in glove with our pension system.
Yeah. Don't panic, Nick.
Exactly, Phil. Mm. What a good name for a book.
1-300-800-222 is the number. Plenty of questions already and plenty of people lining up to have a chat as well. Just before we get into it, you're saying it's still a good deal if you can talk your boss into salary packaging an electric vehicle. Now, you know, if you can find one, because the sales of these things have taken off
since the
oil crisis. I think this is going to change things forever, isn't it?
I agree with you, and I think once people understand, particularly this incentive, which, again, it's one of these things that hasn't been broadly advertised, but it's there nonetheless, and this is all to do with salary packaging your car. Now, normally speaking, it's not that good an idea because the employer incurs this thing called fringe benefits tax, which is quite significant at 47%. It's basically equal to the top marginal tax rate a person would pay plus the Medicare levy. So anytime you package a normal car or you package things like health insurance or travel or anything like that, the boss is paying 47% tax, and usually that's factored into whatever you're paid as a salary. Now, the big thing about EVs, and we're talking about full electric vehicles, so not the hybrids or even the plug-in hybrids, nope, it's got to be a fully electric. If your boss buys the car on your behalf effectively through a thing called a novated lease, all of the finance costs, the loan repayments and stuff, are all done free of fringe benefits tax, which means they're done with your pre-tax income. And look, if you set it up right, you can get insurance is paid, even charging is paid by tax-free income. It's really a no-brainer. And this concession is for cars up to $75,000. It's actually going to change on 1st of April next year. In fact, it cops another change on the in 2029 when it drops down to a 25% discount instead of 100% discount on fringe benefits tax. But look, if you're in the market for an EV and you can have a chat to the boss about packaging your salary, you literally save, well, most of the figures we're looking at, Phil, somewhere between $4,000 and $10,000 a year for most people that are able to package a car that way. Mm. It's incredible.
Interesting. Yeah. All right, how does the capital gains tax changes affect what you've been saying all along? I mean, one of my texters says, I've just bought your book. How do the capital gains tax changes affect the info in the book?
Yeah, well, they will, because they're fundamentally changing the way the tax is calculated. So very briefly to explain what's happening. So up until 1st of July next year, the current system remains, which is 50% of the profit that you make on the sale of the asset. Mm-hmm. What happens on the 1st of July next year, you actually have to get the asset valued, which is easy for things like shares and stuff like that. But properties, you're going to have to get a valuation on the property as of the 1st of July.
If you've got an investment unit, for example.
Yep.
So on the 1st of July next year, you've got to get a value on it.
Yep.
Now you will be paying CGT.
You will. And here's the thing. The ATO will be putting out a model or some sort of a calculator allowed to estimate the value as of that date. But from that date forward, you're up for capital gains tax. It's not a 50% discount anymore. It's simply whatever the growth is, less an allowance for inflation. So that full profit, less the allowance for inflation, gets added to your income for that year. Now, here's the other rub. One of the strategies that most planners and accountants will use is to time the sale of assets around retirement. So it might be that you finish up work on the 30th of June this year, and my advice to you might be, Phil, to sell your investment property next financial year when you no longer have employment income, and that way you've basically got, you know, a reset of your tax-free marginal tax rates for the next financial year, and sometimes it reduces the capital gains tax that you pay quite considerably. Well, from next year, that minimum capital gains tax is going to be 30%. So, you know, there's no avoiding it, unfortunately. So 30% minimum tax on the capital gain from that point forward. It's certainly having an impact already, as we're seeing in the property markets in states where we've got auctions as the main method of selling properties. I think I saw today that it's at a 6-year low, the clearance, and this is in the space of 3 weeks, Phil. So in the space of 3 weeks, we've gone down to a 6-year low in clearance rates. In my home state of WA, they do it by private treaty, very few auctions. So our measure, if you like, is the number of listings for sale. We have seen listings go from about 3,800 to 5,100 in the space of about 4 weeks. It's just amazing how suddenly everyone's on the market trying to offload their properties.
Yeah. Let's take calls. Stephen in Perth. G'day, Stephen.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I'm thinking about investing into the housing market as a second home. And I'm just wondering what's the best entity to buy into. Is it now with super, to go through your super fund, like a self-managed super fund, or is it through a trust? Or
well, yeah, and all of these things are kind of under the microscope at the moment, Stephen. So discretionary family trust, which was often a vehicle used for holding assets and businesses and things like that, they're kind of on the nose now as a result of some proposed tax changes to apply, where the income to the discretionary family trust will be taxed at 30%. So the trust isn't so much of a thing. And, of course, were you planning on living in it at any stage, or is it purely an investment asset?
So make it into a holiday home after about 5 years and you're getting to retirement age. We're around, my wife's 53 and I'm 55.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm thinking to retire around the 60 years of age.
Right. So a couple of other things. No, that's fine. So if you're going to use a holiday home in any capacity yourself, then you certainly can't have it in a self-managed super fund, because there's some very strict rules about arm's length transactions. And so you'd need to be very, very careful about buying it through a discretionary family trust. But, I mean, you've still got some negative gearing benefits associated if it's a new build. So that might be an option if you're thinking of building from scratch. But in terms of buying established properties and stuff, I think, you know, because of the capital gains tax rules, because of the negative gearing changes, it becomes a very, you know, less attractive thing, if you like, than it might have been before budget night. It sounds like it's more of a lifestyle decision, Stephen, is it?
It's partly both. It's lifestyle as well as, investment for short term. So, And if you bought it as a person or a second home, you get hit with the capital gains anyway, don't you?
I mean, yes and no. So if it became your primary residence ultimately, then that, you know, that you can effectively shift across to that as being your primary residence. But if you're going to keep both homes, then no, that's not going to work for you. I should say that on the negative gearing aspects, what you can't do is carry that loss across to other income sources. So that's what the change effectively is. The loss stays with that particular asset, and at some point in the future, you can use it to reduce capital gains on an asset sale, but you're certainly not going to be able to apply it against the other income. So, the tax benefits have really pretty much evaporated.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks for your time.
Thanks, Stephen. Bye-bye. Okay. One of my texters says, hang on, aren't these changes grandfathered? Anyone who owns a property doesn't experience any change, isn't it? Isn't that right?
Yeah. But
so if you already own an investment property.
Yeah, if you're still gearing, if you're gearing one at the moment, you're still okay.
Forget about gearing. What about capital gains?
No. The new rules kick in from July. So everyone's going to be cooked.
They're not grandfathered.
No. The growth from July next year is not grandfathered.
But see, the negative gearing is...
Yes.
So if it's already negatively geared,
yep.
But the point
then you can continue
true. But I mean, of course, negative gearing doesn't last forever. Usually. Okay, capital gains tax. But you don't pay tax on the gain you've already made. You only pay tax on the gain from the valuation next year. Is that right?
Yeah, that's basically it. Yep.
So it's grandfathered. Not grandfathered.
In that sense, that's right.
It's not retrospective.
No.
No, okay. No,
from July 1, it's basically that, you know, and then there's that minimum tax, as I mentioned before, so that all comes into the equation.
Okay. It's only the
That's
gain,
my understanding of it
It's
anyway.
The gain you're making from next year onwards.
Yep, that's taxable.
Okay, David from Minto. Yep. Hello, David.
Hello.
G'day.
I recently applied for a health card. The gentleman at the CES looked at the figures and said, you should be entitled to the age pension.
Mm-hmm.
So he did all the calculations, and I said, I told him I had a superannuation annuity, and I asked him about it, and I was told, no, it's not calculated into it.
Okay.
And I asked him three times.
Yep.
It went to the manager of the CES to check it off before it was submitted, and I asked her, and she said, no, it's not considered in it. My wife and I went and saw then an advisor 18 months later and to get more information, and I said it to him again or this gentleman, and he said, no. 3 years later, I get a phone call from the CS or from a gentleman who said, no, it's taxable income. You're going to have to pay it all back.
So is it a superannuation pension which came from your employer, or was it something that you invested into and bought some time ago?
No, it was from the employer. I was under the old SAS system.
Right, okay. So my understanding is that the asset value is not counted, okay? And that's usually the one that knocks most people off when they're applying for a part pension mm-hmm. or an age pension. However, the income is assessable, and sometimes, and it gets a bit complicated, but depends on the structure of the pension when it commenced, some of it will be deductible off the income. So not all the income is necessarily assessable by Centrelink, but, a good portion of it will be. And that's what captures most people, is the income test. So effectively, you and your good lady could earn per fortnight up to $380 per fortnight before the income test would take effect. And then over and above that, you've got an upper limit, which works out to be about $4,000 a fortnight that you could earn from all sources before you'd lose out under the income test. So where in this letter that you've got, is it a letter of someone's rung you, or what's the...
No, I was rung up and told, no, it's an income.
Yeah, well, it is an income. It's an assessable income, yep.
Yeah, right. But I kept asking them when I was told to apply for it.
Yeah,
and I kept asking, did it affect the pension? And I kept getting told no.
Okay.
It's not accessible. All now, right. As I said, I got told that by a number of people at the CES, and then I get this phone call saying, no, you're going to have to pay a whole lot back.
All right. Well, look, have you had a letter from them yet? Anything in writing?
I haven't had anything in writing from them.
Okay. Well, let's wait till you get something in writing from them. But look, if you've been upfront and told Services Australia Centrelink, which is the parent agent for Centrelink, everything that you're earning along the way, then they have a obligation to try and recover it. But I know that Hank Jongen, who's the general manager of Centrelink in the past, has had situations where Centrelink have been told everything, and there's been an error on their part. They're reasonably pragmatic sometimes in how they deal with these things. So I would wait till the letter turns up, and I'm sure you're stressing about it. But once you've got something in your hand that you can read and hopefully understand, then that's the time to perhaps start asking questions about, well, look, I've told you everything, and just see how that plays out. There's a quite a sophisticated review process to follow. So, hopefully it works out okay for you. But look, the reality is income is assessable. Centrelink have an obligation to recover any overpayments, whether it's the customer's fault or their fault. But as I've said in the past, they've been reasonably practical about these things.
Thanks, David.
Okay, thank you.
Good on you. Bye-bye. 1-300-800-222. Nick Bruning is with us. Andrew from Elanora Heights on the text line. Phil and Nick, I'm hoping you can help me get my head around the new investment property tax arrangements.
Yeah.
Specifically, the minimum tax rate used to work out tax payable. Am I correct in interpreting things as any profit from a sale after applying the 50% CGT discount or indexation after the 30th of June 27, is now taxed at a minimum of 30%, regardless of what your marginal tax rate is in the year of sale?
My understanding...
Is that right?
Yeah. My understanding is the 30% is applicable to the growth post-July next year.
Post-July next year.
So your 50%... income, if you like, so 50% of the sale or the value improvement up until the 1st of July next year gets added to your marginal tax rate, added to your normal marginal income. Look, and as I say, the other income is also added to your assessable income, and many people will be paying more than the 30% tax rate.
Yeah.
But the reality is that's my understanding how it's going to be calculated.
Yeah, because our strategy had been to sell one property a year in retirement.
Yeah, absolutely.
When our marginal rate was low zero and then minimise tax payable. Well, yeah. well, you could still do that, couldn't you?
You could. Well, no, not in terms of deferring and staging your asset sales, because you're going to cop that minimum 30%. Yeah, that's the problem
there. That's true.
But the other carve-out, which is interesting, is the fact that if you're in receipt of any Centrelink income support payment, so we're talking age pensions and job seeker and stuff like that, then the 30% tax is waived. So I would expect to see a lot of people asking questions of financial planners, how do I get a part pension? Because, there's 30% reasons why you'd want to get a pension beyond just the fact that you're going to get the concession card and all the other stuff.
Ron from Ringwood says, with the change in capital gains tax, do I have to get a valuation in June 27? So I know what the capital gains tax in that time, capital gains in that time is. The 50% would apply to that gain. And then the new CGT tax comes in on any increase in capital gain after the 30th of June. Well, that's right. That's what we understand, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so the valuation is, yes, I mean, in the budget papers they spoke about a valuation, but they also said that the ATO will be releasing a calculator, which will allow you to estimate what the property was worth. And obviously if the ATO are putting that out, that'll be an acceptable way of calculating the value.
Your gain in June next year will be subject to the 50% discount, but any gain after that, you'll pay a minimum of 30%.
That's right. Hmm. And it also applies...
Well, not any gain, actually.
Any gain above inflation. Yeah. But the other mini stinker in this is that it also captures pre-September 1985 assets, Phil. So if you inherited a property, let's say in 1982, up until now, you've been not had to worry at all about capital gains tax. But again, our understanding is that from July next year, it'll be subject to that new indexed, the rate above inflation, subject to that tax.
1-300-800-222 is the number. Nick Bruning is with us. Any questions at all? Grab a line, 1-300-800-222. Yeah.
Should also just point out, too, that this stuff is still in the Parliament. And until it's LAW and passed by both houses, it's not law. And interestingly enough, that the stuff the government's just sort of put in now is the capital gains and the negative gearing changes, but the actual trust and all the other controversial stuff has been put off until later. So we don't quite know how that's all going to be applied. And lots of accountants are telling me all sorts of risk or problems with that stuff. So
yeah, that's true. Actually, we haven't yet seen the legislation. That's true.
No.
Toby in Perth. Hello, Toby.
Hello there.
Hi.
Hey, Toby.
I've got the book and I'm halfway through, so thank you for that.
Thank you for that.
Further on to the capital gains that the chap earlier on was asking about, if I want to buy an investment property in the area I want to live in the future, we're not going to live in it until later on.
Yeah.
If you live in that property later on, is there a certain amount of time at your primary residence where you negate capital gains in the future?
No. So the it'll basically be a portion for the number of years you had it as an investment property and so the number of years... Yeah, and then from there on in, it's your private dwelling. Look, one of the other things to be aware of, and I don't think they've changed the law with respect to this, is that if you live in the property itself for, and I think it's a minimum of 6 months, it's either 6 months or a year, but it's a relatively short period of time, you can end up with this capital gains honeymoon where you can go leave that property and you can rent it and do all sorts of things. Obviously, you're not going to get the negative gearing concessions as they used to be now. But you can maintain that exempt property, home dwelling exemption for up to 6 years after you've left it. So that might be something to weigh up as well. So in other words, you move into it initially, establish it as your family home. Then if you move out and go somewhere else, then you can continue to use that property as your family home and for up to 6 years after you've moved out.
And then after you move out, say you move out, you're away for 8 years, say. Six years is still honeymoon.
Well, then I think that's it. It's all over. You're taxable on the whole thing.
Right, on the whole thing. Okay. Okay.
Yep.
All right, Toby.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Toby. Bye-bye. Jackie on the text line says, I'm 66. I'll be working for another year or so. I'd like to withdraw a lump sum out of super to pay out most of my mortgage and also give some to my daughter for her wedding.
What a good idea.
Yeah. Nice mum, Jackie. Other than this, I won't need any more of my super just yet. Should I transfer the money I need into pension mode first? What's the best way to do it?
So the law is that once you get to 65, you've satisfied a condition of release. So under the law, you can absolutely access your superannuation. However, the rider to that is the trust deed rules of your particular super fund.
Mm-hmm.
And some super funds say, and particularly some of the state government ones, will say that, no, you can't access any of your super until you've actually retired. So even if you work beyond 65, it doesn't necessarily mean you can access your super from that fund. So check, firstly, that the fund allows you to access your money. But absolutely. Look, the only reason you would put it into pension phase is that, yes, you might save a little bit of tax, but the downside of it is that you must take out a certain amount per year. Now, that amount at 65 or 66 years of age is a minimum of 5% of the account balance. I mean, you could salary sacrifice and put some money back into super. It's very much dependent on your particular circumstances, Jackie. But, yeah, by all means, it's worth converting across to an account-based pension simply because you're no longer paying any tax on the earnings of the super fund. But you must take out a certain amount of money and, you know, what you do with that money can potentially become problematic. You could put it perhaps back into super, but equally having it sloshing around in a bank account might not be as good as having left it in the super fund.
Mm, okay. Yeah. Alrighty. Pam from Exmouth. G'day, Pam.
Hi, Bill. How are you?
Pretty good.
I have a question about the $30,000 concessional superannuation contributions you can make.
Yep.
I'm wondering who's eligible to make that. Do you need to be an employee, or can you also make a contribution from passive income?
Sure. It's all about age, Pam. So under 67 years of age, anyone can make a concessional contribution, and just for everyone else's benefit, a concessional contribution is where you're claiming a tax deduction or someone else's. It's usually the employer in the case of compulsory super, or you can do a personal concessional contribution to super. Incidentally, Pam, that figure goes to $32,500 in just 3 weeks. So the new financial year means the concessional contribution cap is going from 30 to 32.5. Now, okay. If you're over 67 years of age and up to 75 years of age, you need to satisfy a work test. And the work test says that you must do 40 hours in the 30-day consecutive period for gain or reward. So you can't go and do a voluntary job somewhere. It must be for gain or reward. So if you can tick that box, then you can absolutely put in $30,000 and claim it as a deduction. But you would need to do that before you pay it in, not after. So in other words, satisfy the work test, then you can pop the money into super. But once you get to 75, then that's off as well. You can't put in more money into super.
So under 67, you can put in any amount up to $30,000 and claim tax deduction.
Yep. And if you've got less... Yeah, Jackie, if you've got less than $500,000, you can also use what's called the carryover rules, which is unused concessional contributions from the previous 5 years. So in theory, this year you could make a one-off payment of $167,500, claim it as a tax deduction, but only if your super balance is less than $500,000.
Yeah, I'd love to, but I can't.
Thanks, Pam. Okay. What a problem to have, Phil.
Thanks, Pam. Bye. See ya. Bye-bye. This is Nick Bruning. If you'd like to ask him a question... 1-300-800-222. Mark from Adelaide. Hello, Mark.
Hi, Nick. We have two properties, one of which is our main residence, and the other an investment property that we've had for 8 years. Mm-hmm. We're thinking that we might sell our residence and split some money into each of our super funds and move into the investment property. What happens with CGT then?
Yeah, so, and you never lived in the investment property. You bought it So my understanding is that you can, you get it valued basically at the time that you move in, and that will be subject to capital gains again under the 50% concession if you do it before the 1st of July next year under the 50% discount method. And then when it's ultimately sold way off into the future, you know, it'll be just the tax on that portion. The rest of it would be exempt under the main residence exemption on the capital gains tax stuff.
Right.
Just one other point. The other thing that you've got, if you're going to be doing it with the proceeds of your home, that have you lived in there for more than 10 years?
Yes.
Okay. So you can make use of the super downsizer rules, and that allows you and your partner to stick in up to $300,000. It's a once-in-a-lifetime availability for each individual. But the good thing about that is
$300,000 each,
that's right, yep. But the good good thing about that is that it doesn't, it's not counted as a contribution under the cap rules. So it's not counted as a non-concessional or a concessional cap. So you've got those caps over and above it. And in theory, you could each put in, you know, potentially 690,000. 390 would be the bring forward rule as it applies from the 1st of July, and 300,000 would be your super downsizer contribution. So in theory, you and your good lady could put in more than $1 million into super in one hit.
Yeah, okay. That
would be a nice problem to have too, wouldn't it?
Well, it's a possibility, as she contributed for...
Worth looking at. Yeah.
Good luck with it. Thanks, Mark. Good luck with it. 1300 800 222. Anna says, in relation to primary residence, we've got a family home in Melbourne, but I commute to Sydney and live in a small studio apartment 4 days a week as my residence for work. Is the Sydney apartment subject to CGT? Both properties are jointly owned.
Yeah, it's generally a case of which you decide which property
you can't
is going
have
to be
two
primary residence.
You can't have two.
No. You can have a crossover. I think it allows up to 6 months, but after that, you know, only one can be designated your primary dwelling, and you can kind of choose which one it's going to be. And, you know, some people do that, but
You have to decide which one is which.
Yep.
Jason says, "Please, Phil. After listening to the segment, my head's spinning. I think I'll live like Jesus." Well, Jason, see, but Jesus had some special. He had a few skills though.
He had a couple things up his sleeve.
He could conjure up bread and wine out of nothing. You know. So,
yeah.
Richard from Kalgoorlie. G'day, Richard. G'day.
That's you, Richard. Hello, mate.
Hey, Nick, how are you, mate?
Good.
I got a question. My investment property cost me $400,000. It's worth probably $800 now. And I've got a whole heap of equity in the property. What's stopping me for selling it for $400,000? And I won't have any capital gains tax, and the government won't get anything.
Oh, yes, they will, my friend.
there we go.
Well, yeah, I mean... Yeah, and usually you'd be doing that to a friend or perhaps a family member or something like that. But what the ATO and the good old West Australian State Government Office of State Revenue will do will require a market valuation done by a licensed valuer, not just your friendly real estate bloke, mate, or whatever. And you'll be taxed and you'll be assessed, or the purchaser will be assessed for stamp duty on market value. So all of these little tricks where we...
Yeah,
give
but
things
if I
away
can't
to kids.
Sell it for $800, all I can get is $400. So why am I going to get that?
Well, there's another thing called Part 4A of the Income Tax Act, which is tax avoidance. So you might want to think about that a bit too. But hey, look at it another way, my friend. You only pay tax when you make money. Remember that. So if you haven't made money, you don't pay tax. So at least you'll keep half of it. Yeah.
All right, Richard. Okie doke. Now, where are we? Mel from Geraldton. G'day, Mel.
How you going?
Pretty good.
I just said I'm going on 71.
Yep.
I own my house. I've got a bit of a redraw on it. Next year I want to sell it and go down to Albany and buy an on-site like house on the caravan park and stuff. How do I go with it? I've been in the house. I built it in 1986. I'm still living in it 40 years.
Yeah,
and I just want to know, do I cop any taxes and stuff on it when I sell it and move?
No, you don't, Mel, because it's your primary dwelling. It's going to be completely free of tax. And there's a lot of people, Phil, in WA that do exactly what Mal's doing. They get a property up in sort of north of Carnarvon, which is sort of up in the northwest, and one down
in
Albany.
I'm in Geraldton.
Well, it's getting up that way, isn't it, Mal? But anyway, they switch. In March and September, they switch. So they go down south where it's cooler for the summer month and head up north where it's warmer for the winter month. So September, March is...
It's getting too hot up here for me.
Anyway, look, it's a perfect strategy and, you can use the money that you make out of the Geraldton property sale and perhaps put it into super or whatever, and then that will top up a bit of a pension.
I only paid $34,000 for a house and land.
Yep.
Three bedroom by one with just under 1,000 meter block. And,
yeah, right.
You know, and probably... like I've lived in 40 years, and I've got a bit of a some work to do on it, but you know, I want 500 grand for it. So, you know,
oh, well, there you go. You've added a zero and doubled it, so that's not bad. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks. Good stuff. All right, Mel. Okay. Good stuff, Mel.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, mate. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you. On the text line, where are we? I inherited, this is Ellen. I inherited my parents' home in a country town 20 years ago, and I've used it as a holiday house ever since. It's never been rented. What capital gains tax would I need to pay if I sold it this year?
Yeah, so it will be the value as at the date of death of the property. Once you inherit a property, if it was the primary dwelling, you've basically got 2 years to sell it where there's no capital gains tax implications. But once it's passed into your name, then it's going to be the capital growth from the date of death to the date that you sell it.
The date of your 20 years ago, parents' death, you mean?
Her parents' death, sorry. Yeah, yep, yeah. So we're talking 20 years ago, whatever the value is, and you might not have it, but a value will be able to do a retrospective valuation.
Yeah, you will have to pay capital gains tax.
Absolutely, And basically half the gain, if it's sold this year under the old rules, the 50% discount, so it'll be whatever your profit is over that period, less, you know, if you've done maintenance work and stuff like that, capital works to the property, all that comes into the calculation. But basically, half of that profit will be added to your other income in the year that the property sold. And I should make that point, Phil, at this time of the year, it's the date that the contract is signed, not when you settle. So if you are signing a contract in the next 3 weeks, it will be all applied to this financial year, not next financial year, which is when you might actually get the cash.
Yeah. Andrew from Eleanor Heights just wants to make it clear. Yes, Andrew, I think the answer to this question is yes. To follow up on my previous text, does the 30% minimum tax, CGT tax, apply to just the capital gain post 30 June 27 or to the gain for the total time the property was owned?
My understanding, it's the post-gain.
It's the post-June,
yeah.
I think that's right. Trevor from Bega. Hello, Trevor.
Hello, how are you?
Pretty good.
Yeah, I've just turned 67.
Mm-hmm.
I've just taken out $150,000 out of my super to pay off my unit.
Yep.
So I'm debt-free with that.
Excellent.
Now, I have a little business, a little franchise business, which I make about $2,000 a month out of.
Mm-hmm.
I was told I could put that, get that paid straight into my super and still get the pension.
Look, it's accessible income, and whatever you do with it, you know, you can't hide it in super, basically. But at the end of the day, you can, you know, do up a proper profit and loss. $2,000 a month isn't a lot of money, but it is money that Centrelink will want to know about. But you need to be realistic and say, well, look, you know, these are my expenses and I've got, you know, using a bit of electricity and all that sort of stuff. So do up a bit of a profit and loss statement and present that to Centrelink. And with a bit of luck, they'll be happy to accept that. Do you have an ABN or anything exciting like that, Trevor, or would you just do it sort of at market?
Yeah, we have an ABN number, yeah.
All right, okay. So they definitely do it because you can't hide it.
You can't hide it in super. No.
It doesn't work that way. So it's accessible income. The good news is that $2,000 a month works out to be about $1,000 a fortnight. Since some of it is through personal exertion, you know, you're working, you actually get $300 a fortnight free income, if you like, from that money that you're earning, and then you also got the income free area, which for a single person is 218 a fortnight, or for a couple 380 combined. But the bottom line is, I don't think you'd lose much pension as a result of it. To be honest,
but you will lose some.
Potentially. Yeah.
Okay.
Right, now I'm looking at retiring in July, so in about 6 weeks' time. I get a large payment. Should I put a lot of that in the super?
You've done the sensible stuff, which is pay off the mortgage, which is a great idea. Potentially, you could put it into super to reduce tax, but if it's going to be in July, you're in the new financial year, and if you've retired, you won't have much income, so the tax aspects aren't so great. But once it's in super, and perhaps you convert the remainder into a pension fund, Trevor, the good news is that there's no tax whatsoever on any of the earnings inside the super fund, so you don't have to put it on your tax return, and equally, any money that you take out of super isn't put on your tax return because it's completely tax-free because you're over 60 years of age. So there's a lot of good reasons why super stacks up for people in retirement. So it's probably worthwhile. Always keep a bit of cash in the bank. I like to see people with, you know, 10,000, 20,000 in case the car breaks down or whatever.
Perhaps
have a chat to the super fund or get some advice on the leftovers from the payout.
Okay, Trev.
Happy retirement, my friend.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Trev. Thanks, Trev. Bye-bye. Yeah, I wonder what he's doing, maybe mowing lawns or something, maybe.
I don't know, $2,000 a month, that's handy.
Oh, yeah, sure. Wayne from Mount Evelyn. G'day, Wayne.
How are you going?
pretty good.
Good. Simple question. I've got a few rental properties, which got a bit of a scare after the budget, but that's okay. You know, I'm at ease with that now because it only affects it after 27. Speaking to some friends and everything about, as we know, it's advisable to get a valuation coming up to before the end of June 27. My question is, A, do you have to get a sworn valuation, a licensed valuer, or your local real estate agent?
Right. It's the former, unfortunately. These rules have always been in place. They're nothing special because the tax law changes. Both the ATO and the Office of State Revenue in most states will require to get a licensed valuer to do the valuation. Usually come in with a figure of plus or minus 5%. So you obviously use the figure they've given you, and that's the figure that'll be required. If they don't do it, then often they'll go and get it done, and then they'll slap you with the cost of it. So
Because obviously if you get the latter, you go and get your handling agent. Yeah. They're going to increase the value, aren't they?
Yeah. Well, you've also got this new Butte calculator that's going to come along. You might want to look at that and see what sort of estimation it comes up with under the new model that they've got. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
What sort of money should we be talking for a normal house valuation?
I've been told you're probably looking at $500 to $600, so it's not cheap. And that's for a sort of
What if you don't do it? I mean, you'll have to get it.
Yeah, well, we haven't seen the details of the legislation. I haven't. Might be there now, but I haven't seen it coming out. But my thoughts would be that the ATO will just apply their estimator calculator that they allow people to use and do it that way.
And that'd be tax deductible, I'm assuming.
Yes, it absolutely will be.
Thanks, Wayne.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much.
Thank you, mate. Changes. What do you think about the argument that some people are making? Well, it's good that property prices have come off because this is going to – the whole point of this exercise was to try and make it a bit easier for owners, so people want to live in houses to get into them, and particularly young people.
And I'm perhaps not as popular as I want to be, but I actually don't disagree with the idea of removing some of those tax concessions, simply because, Phil, it's just common sense. If you're bidding on a property and you've got four people there that have got all these tax breaks and one's a first home buyer, they're clearly at a disadvantage relative to the people that have got the tax concessions. So if that stuff's modified or taken away, then in theory you would expect to see the first home buyers have a better opportunity. I think one of the issues, which is probably not explored fully enough, is the removal of rental properties from the market. You've got a lot of investors, and I would expect that most of the people that are selling their properties in Perth now are the investors getting out. That's less rental properties on the market, and that can only mean one thing: rents go up. So, interestingly enough, I think that was fundamentally the reason it was backtracked by Paul Keating all those years ago, because the rental stock just dried up so dramatically that it put even more pressure on housing. So, I don't know. I think we have to see how it plays out, but there's plenty of theories running around at the moment.
We've got lots of listeners everywhere. Joe is texting saying, "I'm tuning in from Munich Airport."
Well,
I've been watching Paris Saint-Germain win the Champions League final. I'm about to get on a 32-hour flight with two stops via New York and then back to Sydney.
Wow.
Good on you, Joe.
Lucky
Thanks
Joe.
For being a loyal nightlife listener, too.
Absolutely.
Quickly, Mike's been waiting on from Oak Park. G'day, Mike.
G'day. How are you, gentlemen?
Pretty good.
Yeah, good. Just a very straightforward question. I own my own place outright, and that's obviously a good thing. I don't have investment properties or anything. But when I go overseas, when I come back again, there seems to be my pension has gone down, my old age pension. And I'm wondering if there's a rationale behind that, because I've got three sisters, and if any of them die at any time, which they're all older than me and I'm pretty old, I want to go and obviously see the funerals and blah, blah.
Absolutely. So the rule is that the actual pension payment that you get per fortnight, so the maximum rate is currently $1,290 for a single person.
Yes. Part of that's what's called a base pension, and the other part's what we call supplements. And they're things like pharmaceutical supplement, an allowance for telephone and internet, and there's an energy supplement. And basically, they are only payable if you're residing in Australia, because that's where you're going to use it. They don't want to provide a supplement for you to pay your power bill in, you know, Southeast Asia or anything like that. So that's why it drops down. There's a minimum period, I think it's 6 weeks, that you can be away. It might be 12, but anyway, it's a period of time that you can be away and still receive the full pension. But once you're away beyond that 6 or whatever weeks it is, then it'll drop down to the base pension. The other rider to that is that if you're a new Australian and you haven't been here for full 35 years, they will also prorata the amount of pension that you receive while you're overseas. So that's the reason it drops, my friend. But when you come home, of course, they know, and up it goes back to the full rate.
That hasn't been the case to date, but I might follow that up.
Well, maybe that's some other assets and stuff. Yeah, it's worth just perhaps going online. If you go via the my.gov.au site and then link to Centrelink, you'll be able to see exactly how they're assessing you. Yep.
Okay. Well, Mike.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mike.
Good luck.
Yep. Well, and you're Mike from Oak Park. And I think we've got probably time for one more. Steve from Taree. G'day, Steve.
G'day, Phil. How you going?
Pretty good.
Look, I've got a query that relates to the application of deeming rules by Centrelink in relation to pension. I had a bit of a tree change. I bought this place about 6 years ago. I should have probably got some financial advice before I did, but I've since learned that the idea was that obviously lifestyle, but also some kind of passive income from the farm in retirement. The complication is that it's a large property, 180 acres, but probably only 70 of it's arable and income producing. What's it? How complex is it with the deeming rule set up? I mean, is it just one individual in Centrelink that?
No. Very, very strict rules. There's a thing called the Social Security Guide that you can Google, and it's like 500 pages exactly how everyone in Centrelink applies it. Look, deeming only applies to financial assets, so it doesn't actually apply to property per se. It's only financial assets. So the deeming rates are a notional rate of interest that Centrelink apply. What you might be referring to is the property value itself being caught up under the asset test, which often happens. And basically, you're allowed to have 5 acres, which might include the buildings and bits and pieces. So 2 hectares under the new currency is exempt from Centrelink under the primary dwelling exemption. But any area of land above that has a deemed asset value, and that could be the thing that's affecting you. You can, have that reviewed, and certainly many people do. If it's sort of all rock and you can't use it for anything, then obviously the value might be less than Centrelink have attributed to it. But find out what the value is that they're going to attribute to it, and then, decide whether you want to appeal it. But many people do, and many people are successful.
And is there any way that you can make sort of impartial inquiries without,
absolutely. Yep, you can go and see a financial information service officer, which is a free service at Centrelink offer. 132300 is the phone number, 132300. Just follow the prompts and make an appointment. You go and sit with them and explain your circumstances, and they're very good.
Okay.
Very good at helping people out.
All right, Steve.
Fantastic. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Steve. Advice. Good. Glad we could help. As Nick is always a great help. Thank you. Julie says, good evening. We're listening on the Indian Pacific as we come through. As we come through Godoblin.
Good on, wherever that is.
Oh, come on. What do you mean, wherever that is? All right, Nick, we'll get you again, Phil, down the track, mate. Thank you.
Look forward to it. Good. Cheers.
Finance with Nick Bruning. Nick is an independent financial advisor, author of Don't Panic, Why You Can Retire With Less Than You Think.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.